Neuroscience and free will, is there really a problem? Contemporary philosophical debates about freedom of the will operate under a common set of assumptions that have been mostly unquestioned for at least the last few centuries. Primary among these presuppositions is that morally significant actions must, in one way or another, be caused by the will of an agent who performs such actions. That is, the kind of actions for which we hold people responsible, for which we might reward or punish people, for which we might laud or shame people, and so forth, must be explained in terms of a certain sort of psychological faculty, the will. For example, if Cormac is to be praised for his having acted in such and such a way, then Cormac must have willed to have acted in that manner. And likewise, if Cormac is to be shamed for having acted in such and such a way, then Cormac must have willed to have acted in that manner. It seems pretty odd to us either to praise or blame Cormac for having done something he had no intention of doing, but only happened to do so accidentally. Thus, so the story goes, morally significant action, in some sense, requires our conscious intention to so act, usually when there were other options available. In this context, the will is taken as a conscious, deliberative power to weigh or evaluate distinct courses of action, which a moral agent wields as the final determining factor in a decision. Okay. That's the standard story. Notice that this conscious intention is supposed to play the final determining role in bringing about a morally significant action. When we talk about an exercise of the will in this context, we typically mean just a conscious state, not just a conscious state that deliberates among available options for acting, but one that decisively determines which of those actions are to be done. In short, the will in the freedom of the will debate is typically thought of as a sort of cause. At least a part of why Cormac has done something morally significant is that he has willed to perform some action in particular among the available options. It is then integral to this approach to moral action that the act of the will occurs antecedently, literally before the action. An exercise of the will is a conscious mental event that occurs prior to the action it supposedly explains. That would seem to be the case necessarily because the common assumption in play is that morally significant action is caused by the will, in much the same sense that the collision of the cue ball with the eight ball is the cause of the eight ball's subsequent residence in the corner pocket. The free exercise of the will is supposed to be what brings about a morally significant action, or what makes it such that that action occurs. Since the agent's exercise of the will is a cause, in that sense, of morally significant actions, the exercise of the will certainly must be antecedent to the action. As the cause of the eight ball's residence in the corner pocket, the cue ball's striking of the eight ball must occur first. Thus, we may take the following as the central, mostly unquestioned assumption of the debate. This is the volitionist thesis that's on your handout. Morally significant action must be caused by an agent's exercise of the will, where an exercise of the will is an antecedently occurring resolution to deliberation among the available options. That is, what people typically mean by the will as it relates to morally significant actions, but we have not said anything about how this sort of volitionism relates to the freedom of the will. Moreover, we have not discussed debates about whether there is indeed anything like freedom of the will, so let's extend our task to those concerns. First, it should be readily obvious in what sense freedom is related to our going concerns. It is difficult to see how Cormac's actions can be morally significant unless those actions are performed freely. Certainly, it must have been up to Cormac to perform an action if we are either to praise or blame him for doing so. Remember that the volitionist assumption takes an exercise of the will as a sort of cause, that is, the cause of a morally significant action. Thus, it would then seem that Cormac's exercise of his will must be free. It was up to him as to how he would exercise his will. The debate over freedom of the will, at least in the mainstream of philosophy for the last few centuries, is then over the cause of this cause. The question is whether the exercise of the will is itself caused by something outside of the agent, or whether the agent causes this act of the will independently of all external causes. philosophers who have come to be known as compatibilists, and I have a definition of this position in your handout, claim that an exercise of the will can be characterized as free even when it is caused by something outside of the agent's control. Although Cormac's exercise of the will was caused by factors beyond his control, possibly coming to him through a series of determining causes dating back to the Big Bang or some such, it can still result in a morally significant action. As long as Cormac knew what he was doing, he wanted to do it, and his knowing and wanting constitute the last link in the causal chain leading up to the act, however long this series of causes might have been, then the compatibilist claims there is nothing more needed to constitute Cormac's action as morally significant. The compatibilist is so named because she claims that the exercise of free will is compatible with causal determinism, the claim that all occurrences have prior causes that necessitate their coming about. Philosophers who have come to be known as libertarians, and not to be confused with followers of Ron Paul, deny that the morally significant action is compatible with causal determinism. Philosophers who have come to be known as libertarians deny that that morally significant action is compatible with causal determinism. According to the libertarian, in order for Cormac to perform a morally significant action, his willing cannot be caused by factors outside of his control. There must be some sort of gap between Cormac's exercise of the will and any prior series of causes leading up to it. Thus, there must be at least one sort of event for which there is no prior determining cause. For example, Cormac's exercise of his will to bring about a morally significant action. In a way, Cormac's exercise of the will is uncaused or self-caused. There is no cause for it in the billiard ball sense of cause, but that Cormac brought it about. And there is no cause for his bringing it about, but that he brought it about. The libertarian then argues that causal determinism must be false, because our exercise of the will in the bringing about of morally significant action is not in fact determined by any prior cause. Finally, there are philosophers who have come to be known as hard determinists. Obviously, like compatibilists, such philosophers accept causal determinism. Right? They claim that every occurrence has a prior necessitating cause. That's the determinist part of hard determinism. The hard part, as it were, stems from the fact that these philosophers believe that causal determinism is incompatible with morally significant action. On the one hand, the hard determinist agrees with the compatibilist that every occurrence has a prior necessitating cause. But on the other hand, she agrees with the libertarian that morally significant action requires that our exercises of the will are, at least sometimes, not necessitated by any prior causes. Thus, the hard determinist claims that there are no free exercises of the will, and therefore no morally significant actions, a hard doctrine indeed. Each of these positions has generated puzzles and controversies that have kept academic philosophers working and tenured for many decades. In the case of libertarianism, one should wonder how much sense can be made of the notion of an uncaused occurrence. At the very least, it would seem that an uncaused exercise of the will would be arbitrary in a way that would render the resulting action not merely significant, but capricious. Moreover, attempts to alleviate this problem seem to threaten an infinite regress of causes. In the case of the compatibilists, one does well to wonder in what sense we can hold someone responsible for an action while also maintaining that her doing so was beyond her control. Sure, maybe Cormac's will provided the most direct cause of the action, but his exercise of the will, according to the compatibilist, was not within his voluntary control. In what sense, then, can we say that that action was really under Cormac's voluntary control at all? Finally, in the case of the hard determinist, there are few terribly good arguments for accepting a strong version of causal determinism, and quite a few interesting reasons drawn from both philosophy and natural science for doubting it. At the very least, we should not be too quick to think the burden of proof favors such a grim position. To say that the philosophical literature inspired by these concerns is legion is an understatement, and surely I have offered you little more than facile caricatures of what are, in all fairness, very subtle positions sensitive to the simple objections I have sketched here. That is all well and good, because my intent in what follows is not to take a partisan stand within the mainstream contemporary debate about freedom of the will, for example, to defend libertarianism over and against the other two positions, or to prove that compatibilism cannot deliver a legitimate account, or some such. But what I do want to show is that all these positions are built on assumptions about morally significant actions that are entirely, that are either probably debunked or were philosophically misguided in the first place. In other words, my intent is not to resolve the typical debate in favor of one of the standard positions, but to offer you a route toward a way of thinking about morally significant action that does not lead to these sorts of conundrums in the first place. What I do want to introduce as a threat to our notion of moral freedom is a position I'm going to call neuroskepticism. Okay. And the primary concern for the neuroskeptic, not surprisingly, is certain findings over the last several decades that tell against the voluntarist thesis. In particular, these findings are claimed to show that conscious deliberation is in fact not the causal antecedent of our actions. In 1964, two German scientists, Kornhuber and Dieke, set out to investigate the degree to which the brain is actively involved in the decision-making process. To that end, they set up an experiment in which human subjects were asked to tap their finger on a finger on their right hand at whatever interval they chose, while Kornhuber and Dieke were recording changes in brain activity. They found that there was indeed a spike in brain activity leading up to the subject's finger tapping. They called this increased activity in the subject's brains the readiness potential, as they interpreted it as the nervous system's preparation to bring about an action. The discovery of the readiness potential was certainly a big deal scientifically, as it showed that the brain is something of an active participant in bringing about actions and decisions. These scientists' experiments hinted at some interesting philosophical questions. Nevertheless, their discovery of the readiness potential was not proposed as a reason to call the notion of freedom of the will into doubt. Maybe the conscious will is the cause of the readiness potential. Later experiments, along these lines by Benjamin Leavitt, however, do seemingly raise just such a specter. Leavitt was intrigued by the fact that there is a big lag of time between the gathering of the readiness potential and the actual downstream movement. I mean, it's not big in our sense, but it's big in the neuroscientific sense, where you know things are measured at the speed of electricity. And they did find that there was a fraction of a second lag there. Why is there a substantial gap in time between the decision to act and the subsequent activity? Leavitt looked into this by way of varying the original experiment a bit. He had the human subjects use a sort of clock to record when they consciously decided to move their finger, while their brains were simultaneously being monitored for the onset of the readiness potential. To make a very long story short, the incredible result that Leavitt found was that the subject's conscious sense of their decision occurred after the buildup of the readiness potential. That is incredible, as it shows that the brain has already, in some sense, decided to perform the action before the subject's conscious sense of having made such a decision. The conscious part of the decision seems to come only after the fact, so it plays no role in determining what will actually happen. The conscious act of the will is just as much an effect of the realization of the readiness potential as the actual physical movement. Remember the shared assumption of the contemporary free will debate, the volitionist thesis. Once again, morally significant action must be caused by an agent's exercise of the will, where an exercise of the will is an antecedently occurring conscious resolution of deliberation among the available options. Libertarians, hard determinists, and compatibilists all agree that antecedent conscious deliberation is a necessary condition for morally significant actions. Because such action must, in one sense or another, be free, and free actions must be caused by the conscious will. Leavitt's experiment, however, seems to show that the conscious act of willing is not antecedent to the readiness potential, and is therefore not the cause of the action. The threat to freedom and moral agency does not come from the plausibility of determinism or the implausibility of compatibilism or libertarianism. Rather, the problem is that the will does not seem to do any significant work in causing our activities. All the real work seems to be done by the neurological activity that is itself antecedent to our supposed acts of will. Experiments much like Leavitt's have been replicated with similar results, and some researchers have come to similar conclusions using much more sophisticated technology. For example, C.S. Soon and collaborators were able to predict subjects' decisions before they themselves were consciously aware of them to a degree of 60% reliability using functional magnetic resonance imaging. There is no small amount of properly scientific controversy over these experiments and their interpretation. Serious questions have been raised regarding how Leavitt and others have set up their experiments and whether they really do support what they are claimed to show. I will not wade into these scientific weeds, not because I doubt there's anything to worry about in that vicinity, but because it goes far beyond, as they say, my meager scientific pay grade. Thus, I'm happy to concede that Leavitt and subsequent experimenters following suit have in fact shown that their subjects were not acting freely, despite their own conscious sense of doing so, by the standards of the volitionist thesis. I do not find that terribly troublesome because, as I shall argue below, freedom that is really worth having has very little to do with the volitionalist thesis. Okay. There are three very important facts about the neuroskeptical case that we need to focus on in order to understand the philosophical implications of the scientific evidence they appeal to. The actions, and I'm reluctant to even call them actions, that the subjects perform in the Leavitt-style experiments are arbitrary, they're insignificant, and they're episodic. By arbitrary, I mean that the performances in the Leavitt-style experiments are not what recent philosophers call reason-sensitive. That is, they are not doings that can be rationally justified. When asked to tap your finger at any interval of your choosing, without being given any further end this activity, this interval tapping might serve, your decision for one interval over another is not something for which you can give a reason. Supposing Cormack were a subject in the Leavitt-style experiment, when asked why he tapped his finger at any given moment as opposed to any other moment in the infinity of perfectly good moments at which he might have tapped, there is no reason he could give over and above the bald assertion, "That's just what I chose to do." Notice, however, that "I chose it" might be a cause of acting, but is not a reason for acting. If I were to ask Cormack, "Why did you leave for swim practice early today?" and he replied, "Because I chose to do so," I would point out to him that he really has not answered my question. It's an actual event, in fact. Okay. Of course he chose to do so. That is why I am asking him why he left early. If he hadn't decided the matter, I wouldn't be asking him why he did it. I wanted to know why he did it, not the causal process that led up to or finalized the decision. Typically, a reason for acting is an end that the agent aims to achieve by such an action. If Cormack were to answer my question so that I could get some extra laps for my breaststroke, or so I could goof around in the pool with the other guys, whatever I might think of the relative worth of these different justifications for his action, either of these replies provides an intelligible reason for acting. He's making sense now. That is, they tell us to what end he thought he was moving toward when he left for practice early. Notice that tapping your finger at some random interval is not reason sensitive at all in this way. The performance is arbitrary in that it serves no end, and an agent acting in such a way can offer no meaningful justification for when they so acted. Notice that a reason for acting is an end that would plausibly justify such an action, which is to say that reasons for acting are typically taken as goods that the agent expects or hopes will be brought about by such action. This emphasis on the notion of reasons as goods highlights the insignificance of the performances of the subjects in the Leavitt-style experiments. I take it that only ends that can be seen as being significant to us are intelligible explanations of our actions. To say that I acted to achieve some end implies that such an end is a good to me. Certainly a condition of something being good to me is that it's something I care about, or it contributes to something I care about. In other words, when I ask Cormack, "Why did you do that?" I am looking for his reasons for his actions, and only ends of acting that have significance to him would serve as a plausible answer to that question. So that I could get some extra laps for my breaststroke, or so that I could goof around in the pool with the other guys, serve as reasons for Cormack's early departure because we can understand these states of affairs as goods or contributing to goods he is likely to care about, becoming a better swimmer or fun with his buddies. In short, reason-sensitive doings matter or have significance to the agents who perform them in virtue of the goods they serve. An end the agent simply does not care about is not really why that agent performs such an action, or at least it leaves the real justification for an action unknown. Notice that in the Leibniz-style experiments, the finger-tapping performances of the subjects are quite insignificant to them. It is hard to believe that any subject cared about which moment she tapped her finger as opposed to any of the other infinity of moments she might have tapped. Nothing is at stake in which arbitrarily chosen moment you tap your finger. Finally, the performances in the Leibniz-style experiments are episodic, in the sense that the decision leading up to them takes place at a discrete clockable moment. That is, we are dealing with events that can be shown to have occurred at a specific time, or at least during a definite hard-edged time interval. The subjects in the Leibniz experiment were asked to give the exact time, or nearly so, at which they consciously made the decision to tap their finger. Likewise, the readiness potential was detected at a definite time. Both the conscious perception of the decision and the neurophysiological activity were timed down to the fraction of the second. It is only because the decision to act in these cases can be precisely characterized as a discrete episode that we are concerned with which event, the conscious episode or the neurophysiological episode, comes first. Since the decision to tap your finger arbitrarily and insignificantly is a discrete episode, it makes sense to look for its cause among other antecedent discrete episodes. A necessary condition for one discrete episode explaining another is that the one doing the causing comes first in time. For this reason, the Leibniz-style experiment takes the conscious episode and the neurophysiological episode in a sort of competition for who goes first, wherein the winner is the real decision responsible for the subsequent finger tapping. Now, I am not concerned with whether Leibniz-style experiments show that conscious volitions are in fact epiphenomenal in cases of arbitrary, insignificant, and episodic decisions. In fact, I would expect that organisms, even rational and reflective organisms like us, would have a mechanism wherein they could make they could determine actions in an arbitrary way on a split second's notice. There is not a lot of time for neat reason sensitivity when the saber-toothed tiger shows up on the prehistoric plains of sub-Saharan Africa. It is better to do something rather than nothing in such a situation. Even running in an arbitrarily chosen direction ups your chances of not getting eaten better than remaining stationary while wrought with indecision. True that may be, but how relevant is this sort of activity to morally significant action? Take, for example, my decision to marry Jennifer. Was that decision arbitrary? Hardly. I could cite many reasons rendering that course of action perfectly rational, even impeccably justified. If you knew her better, you'd agree. A decision to marry a particular person is certainly something we would expect to be reason sensitive in this way. This decision had the highest significance to me because it was a consequence of and partly formed my commitment to a certain way of life. We see this kind of decision as important or grave because it plays that sort of life-defining role. A decision gains moral significance in due part to the fact that it reflects a commitment to a particular vision of what counts as a good life. They aim at goods that matter to us because of their role in what we take as the point of our lives. Morally significant actions either define our notions of the good life, or they are important consequences of our existential commitments. That is why these decisions stand out to us so much. Further, notice that the decision to marry Jennifer was not episodic. There was no one clockable moment at which I can say I made the decision through a conscious act of will. In such decisions, there is rarely, if ever, that eureka moment when one decides all at once to go forward with this course of action. It is often much more like finding oneself in a state of having resolved to take such a course. There was not a specific day and time in the winter of the year 2000 at which I decided to marry Jennifer, though I know at some time in that vicinity I crossed the threshold. No doubt there were many millions of discrete events whirling around in my mind and my brain during those months. Nevertheless, just as the addition of no one drop of rainfall makes the end of a drought, no one of those episodes amounted to making the decision. Indeed, if you recollect most of the really important decisions you have made in your life, the ones with the greatest moral significance, the resolutions that have done the most to define or to confirm who you are, you will find that there was no discrete moment of decision, but a sort of finding oneself in a commitment after a process of deliberation. As to when exactly the process of deliberation resolved itself into a decision to act is something about which I am happy to concede there is no absolute fact of the matter. I clearly did decide to marry Jennifer. It was an impeccably good decision, and yet there is an inherent ambiguity as to when I actually made the decision. The temporal ambiguity of morally significant decision-making, or at least some of it, brings us to the final salient feature of morally significant actions. Morally significant actions, by definition, are reason-sensitive, but notice that they are often, maybe most often, only sensitive to reasons retrospectively. As Alistair MacIntyre puts it, quote, that it is only in the course of the movement of the goals, in the movement that the goals of the movement are articulated, is the reason why we can understand human affairs only after the event. In other words, often the reason for taking some of the most important actions in my life, those that most define my commitments to a conception of the good life, are not entirely transparent to me while I am making those decisions or performing those actions. Often the full reasons for action, the reasons that fully justify it, are only available to us after the fact, after we have performed the action, our reasons can now be seen and can be seen as justifying what we have done. Once again, my decision to marry Jennifer is just such a decision. Though that decision is perfectly justified by the reasons available, and I can understand those reasons as justifying that decision, those very same reasons were not entirely transparent to me in the winter of 2000. In fact, though they were maybe quite opaque to me then, 2 decades later, they are far clearer. Indeed, I suspect, God willing, those reasons will be even clearer to me in 2 more decades. The point here is that our most significant decisions, the sorts of decisions we are raising our children to be able to make, the justifying reasons for those decisions may not, usually are not, explicitly and completely available to us until well after the fact. In short, reason sensitivity is mostly retrospective. We may then conclude that morally significant actions are not arbitrary, are non-arbitrary, meaningful, significant, non-episodic, and retrospectively justified. Notice that the sorts of doings considered by the Leavitt-style experiments are precisely the contrary of such actions. They are arbitrary, insignificant, episodic, and wanting for antecedent justification. The doings of these experimental subjects just are not the sorts of doings at all relevant to our status as moral agents. This boils down to the classic apples versus oranges sort of confusion. Certainly, Leavitt and those who follow in his train may well show that in cases of randomly chosen finger tappings, we are not acting as bona fide moral agents. But nobody should have thought that we would be so acting in those sorts of cases. Leavitt's experimental setup did not put any significant good in the breach regarding the subject's decisions, which means that whatever he shows, it has nothing to do with morally significant actions. The reason many people have been led to neuroskepticism based on the Leavitt-style experiments stems from the fact that the libertarian, compatibilist, and hard-determinist debate has mostly framed modern thinking about these issues. And all parties to this debate accept the volitionist presumption that morally significant actions must be caused by antecedent conscious acts of the will. The neuroskeptic rightly calls volitionalism into question based on these neuroscientific findings. Notice, however, that our discussion thus far shows that there is very good reason to wonder whether the modern volitionist approach to morally significant actions is entirely wrongheaded. That is, as we have discussed above, many, if not most, of our morally significant actions are not the productions of antecedent conscious acts of will. What renders one of Cormac's actions morally valuable is not its being caused by an act of will he consciously controlled, but because that action is something he can give reasons for subsequently, and it has life-defining significance for him. The Leavitt-style experiments are irrelevant to our status as moral agents, not because these experiments are somehow unsound scientifically, but because they address moral significance or human freedom in terms of a misguided framework for thinking about these issues. The non-arbitrary, meaningfully significant, non-episodic, retrospectively justified deliberation that seems to fit the phenomenology of our real-world decisions is what Aristotle calls deliberate choice. A deliberately chosen action, according to Aristotle, is voluntary in the sense that its starting point is internal to the agent. By starting point, Aristotle means that the reason, the end, the goal, or the good of the action is something that the agent accepts for herself. That is, in a voluntary action, The aim for good is something the agent has internalized. It is something she wants, and is therefore something she can cite as her reason for acting. For example, a situation in which an agent is forced to commit a terrible act in order to prevent a tyrant from harming his or her family is, in a sense, involuntary. The reason for the action is not the agent's reason. The agent is forced in as much as he or she does not see the action as choice-worthy, as something for which good reasons can be given, but is being moved by the dictates of someone else. Any reasons she might cite for herself are not the reasons why this unfortunate situation has come about. Similarly, Aristotle believes we should not hold the crew of sailors responsible for dumping a ship's cargo in order to save the ship from a storm. Certainly it was within their power not to jettison the cargo, but they did not act because they saw the destruction of the cargo as an action justifying end. There is a sense in which the sailors did not voluntarily destroy the cargo. That is not what they wanted to get out of the voyage. The internalization of reasons is the choice part of deliberate choice. The deliberative component stems not from the agent's relation to the ends or goods at stake in the activity, but the means she has taken toward achieving those ends. That is, for any given end, any given end is achievable by multiple means. A deliberate choice is one in which the agent has a rational relationship to the means she has taken. The agent can justify why she has taken this means to the end rather than other ways she might have gone about pursuing that good. In short, for Aristotle, deliberately chosen actions are reason sensitive both in terms of the goods being pursued, the agent acts for goods she has internalized, and the means for pursuing, the agent can justify the means employed. Let's be careful with this talk of deliberate choice. The phrase suggests to us antecedent conscious choosing, but I think that is mostly not what Aristotle had in mind. Indeed, for Aristotle, the practically virtuous person, someone who's really good at making deliberative choices, spends very little time doing much in the way of conscious decision making. Rather, the virtuous person is someone who is so confirmed and habituated in good practical reasoning that her actions take very little, if any, conscious reflection in order to come out well. The virtuous person's reason sensitivity, in all but the really tough cases we examine in artificial puzzles contrived for philosophy courses, is retrospective. Whether she has consciously entered into a deliberative process, making both her ends and available means explicit to her, prior to acting is beside the point, though after the fact she can certainly cite her reasons for acting, both the good she pursued and the preferability of her means to get them. Moreover, the virtuous person will be right about these reasons in two senses. The reasons she cites are indeed good reasons for acting, and those are indeed the reasons that she acted on. We are correct to require that our morally significant actions are explained by deliberate choices. That is, the decisions to act that define or confirm who we are and how we want to live should be products of reasons we have internalized and executed by means we can justify. Maybe all of this is something only available to us retrospectively, but moral freedom is largely about getting things right. Notice that the great threat to our moral freedom is not causal. Modern libertarians, compatibilists, and hard determinists are worried about whether we are caused to act by events internal or external to our will. But on the account I am offering, maybe something not too far from Aristotle's, those sorts of worries have nothing to do with moral freedom. Rather, the great threat to moral freedom is ignorance. Rational deliberation is a state of knowing why one has acted in a certain way. Moral freedom and moral virtues that follow upon it begins with a kind of knowing. One must know the ends one ought to pursue for her own good, and one must know the best means for doing so. Thus, there are relatively mundane, ground-level facts about the available goods and the available means for pursuing them that one must know in order to engage in deliberative choice. One must know what to do and how to do it. Ignorance of these facts is one way to bring about moral failure. Indeed, Aristotle defines vice as a sort of ignorance about what one should do for her own good. There is, by my lights, a more insidious sort of ignorance threatening our deliberative choice. As I've implied above, our reason giving for our actions must not be a just-so story about what might have motivated our actions. A justification for actions, at least one that comes from well-executed deliberative choice, should not merely be an ad hoc tale about what could have been my reasons for acting, putting myself in the best light, but what reasons actually did move me to do what I have done. The deliberation of a virtuous person is not retrospective vindication, but a serious attempt to assess what accounts for her having done what she did. For example, if Cormac accounts for his early departure for swim practice in terms of his desire to get extra laps in for the breaststroke, then he has exercised practical reason well, only if that really is why he left early, and not because he merely wanted to splash in the pool with his friends. Thus, moral freedom requires not only a knowledge about the nitty-gritty of how the world works, the goods best to pursue and the means best to achieve them, but likewise a good bit of self-knowledge. Our own intentions and reasons for acting must be transparent to ourselves. Otherwise, there is no way to distinguish a life full of ad-libbed self-indications, a life lived at best accidentally well, from an objectively good life. Indeed, the tradition of Greek tragic drama, we find this threat of a distorted understanding of our own motivations as posing the worst threat to our well-being. Take the most obvious example of Sophocles' Oedipus. His problem was not a knowledge of the appropriate ends and means. On that score, he acted in a way that any aristocratic Greek would have seen as magnificent. Nor was his will directly caused by a series of physical causes originating outside of him. Or at least that worry does not seem to be at all in Sophocles' mind. Rather, what leads Oedipus's ruin is his systematic distortion of his understanding of who he is and what ultimately accounts for his motives. This may even be willful ignorance, as Oedipus knew well the prophecy of his patricide and incest, and the reader cannot help but find it hard to believe that he might never have noticed the striking physical resemblance between himself and his wife, nor the odd coincidence that he just happened to kill a stately figure on his way to meeting her. It seems then that Oedipus had, prior to the revelations in the drama, completely failed to put himself under any sort of significant rational scrutiny. It was that possibly willful self-ignorance that accounts for Oedipus's terrible ruin. It is no accident that Sophocles has the tidings of Oedipus's horrifying wrongdoings originate from the Oracle of Delphi, where the motto, "Know thyself," was inscribed, and Socrates claims to have learned that the unexamined life is not worth living. Of course, Oedipus Rex is far-fetched, but today we have even more reason to be worried over the possibility of our powers of deliberate choice being distorted by self-ignorance. There is, in fact, a good bit of scientific evidence, drawn from a broad spectrum of fields, that should lead us to wonder how transparent our own reasons for acting are to even ourselves. For example, there's a significant finding in which experimental subjects were divided into teams by what they knew to be an arbitrary means. As soon as these subjects were asked to compete in simple games, they showed a proclivity toward highly competitive actions and even cheating in order to defend what they now took to be the superior group. Moreover, evolutionary psychologists have done much to show that the ability to separate other humans into convenient in-groups and out-groups likely played a very large role in the original development of the human psyche and influences our group identifications even to this day. In light of this sort of evidence, how confident can you be regarding the rational nature of your allegiance to any sort of group? Is our allegiance something rationally grounded or a convenient grouping that allows for an easier prosecution of our selfish interests? Clearly, such a distortion is something that threatens our deliberations. Other studies by social psychologists have shown distressing roles of various biases in our judgments regarding other people. For example, one famous study showed that resumes with traditionally African-American names consistently received less interview interest than those with the exact same qualifications, but bearing traditional European names. There are other studies showing that whites tend to interpret black faces as angrier than white faces, given the same expression. And there are others showing that college professors are more likely to respond to emails signed by traditionally European names as opposed to traditionally African-American names. Moreover, instruments such as the Harvard Implicit Bias Tests have shown that distressing levels of racial, gender, religious, and other forms of biases in the cognitive backgrounds of people who consciously would not identify themselves as racist, sexist, and otherwise bigoted. I was very troubled by the results when I took these in. In this light, how certain can you be without explicit scrutiny that you have really operated free from unfounded biases when making judgments about the abilities or character of other people? Other social psychological studies have shown that people who have just found a coin in a phone booth are overwhelmingly more likely to help someone who has dropped a folder full of loose papers than those who had not been so fortunate as to obtain a quarter just before. And whether someone is willing to help another person by changing a bill is strongly influenced by the presence of the smell of fresh bakery in the air. Okay. A famous study shows that a group of seminarians who had been tasked with getting across town in order to give a talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan could be predicted on the likelihood of stopping and helping someone in dire distress based on how hurried they were to get to the place for their lecture. It seems that what moved them was not their consciously held moral principles, as outlined in the parable, but their need to be on time. In light of these studies, how certain are you of your conscious stories about why you have decided to help or not help another person? These deliverances of the social sciences, and I have only mentioned a few among many, many that are available, clearly show that there are likely distortions of our self-understandings that undermine the very foundations of our moral freedom. Notice, however, I do not say that the social sciences threaten our moral freedom. Rather, my point is that a confrontation with the social sciences shows us about our, my point is that a confrontation with the social sciences, with what the social sciences show us about ourselves and what might really be motivating our actions, is a necessary step in our achieving bona fide moral freedom. We can only begin to expunge our dangerous cognitive blind spots by first exposing the most dangerous kinds of ignorance we have about ourselves. As Alistair MacIntyre once again puts it, quote, education in the virtues consists in key part in making those so educated aware in detail of the possibilities of error and of the errors which each of them will particularly be inclined because of temperament or social role or whatever. Here the traditional insights of Aristotelian Thomism need to be enriched by more recent findings, end quote. From MacIntyre, today the Oracle of Delphi calls us to a sociological self-knowledge, as he puts it, that amounts to, quoting again, a grasp of the nature of roles and relationships in which one is involved, of the shared assumptions of those with whom one interacts, and of what in those roles, relationships, and assumptions obstructs the exercise of rational agency, and of what the possibilities are of acting so as to transform them, end quote. Failure to take seriously what the social sciences show us about our condition, especially what we ourselves could not know about ourselves, looms as a self-imposed ignorance no less likely to bring us to ruin than Oedipus's deluded understandings of his own actions. Of course, we are not likely threatened by anything so stark as unwitting acts of patricide and incest, but it is not too far better to be led by self-ignorance to participate in systems of racism, sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, and many other forms of exploitation and bigotry. Thank you.